What's up, everybody? This is Radio Free Nintendo, episode 227. Jackie! Nobody gets that joke.
I get it.
Well, you would. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz.
That's all he gets for his appreciation.
I appreciate your humor. Fuck you.
It's all right.
I look down on you.
That's how it is. Fine line between love and hate. Last week was all love. This week it's all hate.
There's a little too much love.
With me as ever, John Lindemann.
Okay. What's going on?
Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
And James Jones.
Good whatever time of day it is.
I'm back home. Very glad to be home and catching up on a lot of things and getting back into the swing of it with RFN. We've got a lot of fun stuff to talk about today. Coming up very soon, we're going to have a 3DS version of New Business with James Charlton. And then we're going to do a big stack of listener mail. First up, I did want to say that thanks to everybody who actually made it through the last episode.
Me, most of all.
There were some controversial elements.
Controversial.
Not there's anything wrong with that.
Banned in 12 states level of controversial.
I will say that in terms of the song, we got about 50% of people who appreciated it on some ironic level and 50% who hated it and said, please never do that again. Which I think is perfect.
50% of people out there are haters, is what that means, with a Z.
No, that's exactly the reaction that I expected and hoped for.
Don't hate, congratulate people.
Congratulate what?
Well, as I posted on our Facebook page, that little four-minute song took about 15 minutes to record and about 3 hours to edit, so...
And I thought I've been wasting my time.
Yeah, well, anyway, it's done, it's behind us, and it's time to move on. So this week, we're not going to do a regular new business because a lot of us are playing kind of older stuff or just catching up or we're waiting for new games to come in. So instead, we're going to click away to James Charlton and talk with him about the recent Nintendo World event in Japan where he played and saw a whole lot of stuff on 3DS. Okay, well, I'm here with Greg once again, and also James Charlton.
Hello, everybody.
Yes, we got two Brits on the show right now. James is calling in from Japan, and he just attended the Nintendo World event in, near Tokyo, I suppose, at the Makuhari Mess. So, James, can you've written some really nice content for the website, and I would highly encourage everyone to go check that out because that's, you know, really in-depth and detailed, and it is accompanied by a lot of news that sort of came out around that event, too, little details about the 3DS, mostly in terms of Japanese launch and things like that. Mm-hmm. But can you give us a flavor for what this event was like and how it would compare to other gaming events that you've been to in Japan?
Well, you can't really compare it with TGS. It was a very kind of, it was a public show, so everybody was there. You know, there were families, kids, people of all ages there.
Well, how would it compare to the TGS public day, though?
Well, TGS public day is more like, TGS, you know, nerd day, isn't it? Because they're not normal people. They're the game fans, right? You know, everybody came to this one. So like, you know, the Nintendogs crowd, you know, the brain training crowd, you know, they were there. Mm-hmm. It was only one hall where TGS is obviously four or five halls sometimes. And this was just one. It was actually a hall I'd never been in before, but it was very simple, very, you know, clean, very nicely laid out, very easy to get around. And it was nowhere near as busy as CGS. There was a lot of people there, but you just couldn't compare the two.
And, you know, as we know from many stories and many other events, Japanese people seem to love standing in line for things.
The line game, yeah.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about, you know, how the lines compared for different parts of this, but there was like a section of playable demos, as you would expect, and very long lines for those. But then there was also some kind of free-for-all wall, like places where you could just view and not touch a lot of different videos, right?
Exactly. It was very much kind of like an art gallery kind of thing. People were just walking past and just, you know, having a quick glance in. But there was one video in particular. People were queuing up to watch the video, and that was Mario Kart 3DS. Oh. So people were queuing up just to see the video of that, and it was only about 30 seconds long, if that. and then the next person would come up and look at the video, and, you know, it was kind of funny. And I did queue up to watch it. it was like 10 minutes. It was 10 minutes to see the video. But compared to the Ocarina of Time 3D, that was 90 minutes to play that demo, which I didn't do.
Okay, so those were the two or three major differences, I think, with the demos that were shown at E3 and then in the UK right after E3 that Greg played last year, which is that Kid Icarus was actually playable this time instead of being a sort of interactive video, and Zelda, I guess, was playable for the first time, whereas that was about a 30-second video when I first saw it. I think Resident Evil was more playable this time, so maybe we can talk about that a little bit too, because that was not much of a demo at E3. But let's start with Kid Icarus. I mean, this is Nintendo's sort of highest profile first party game. It's not a launch title. It's going to be coming out sometime later in 2011. But what are your first thoughts on actually getting to play Kid Icarus?
Well, I didn't really have any expectations for it going in. And I was like trying to work out what kind of game it was going to be, because I couldn't quite figure out if it was going to be like a, you know, a rail shooter for most of it, or if it was going to be this, you know, kind of 3D exploration game with shooting. And even now I'm not quite sure what kind of game it is. There are, you started the demo with a flying section, shooting at things coming at you in 3D, and things moving by very quickly. You know, you just got few seconds to get shots in, kind of thing. It felt more like an intro to the level rather than actually a major gameplay element, but I guess that could be extended in the final game.
Were you controlling Pit or just a cursor?
Both. You were controlling Pit with the analog stick, the slide pad, and you were aiming with the stylus.
So very Star Fox-y at this point.
Well, not quite like that, because you had independent control, whereas in Star Fox, you aim where the ship is pointing to.
More Sin of Punishment-ish.
Yes, exactly. Yes, Sin of Punishment, exactly. And then when you landed to the ground section of the level, then obviously you're moving Pit around in 3D and still aiming with the stylus. So I thought the controls, I mean, the flying controls were fine. But when I got on the ground, it really felt a bit kind of sluggish. I mentioned in my impressions that the way that you run and you dash and you dodge is using the slide pad in a very kind of Smash Brothers style way, as you could probably guess. You kind of smash the stick to the side and he'll dodge to the side. But if you smash and hold it, then he'll run in that direction. But there wasn't any analog between those two. It was kind of like, if I just pushed it slightly, he would walk very slowly.
Yeah, that's weird. I mean, it seems like he's passing on one of the primary things about having, you know, an analog stick on a handheld. Is that, because that kind of, to me, sounds analogous to like the stuff that's in Sakurai's Kirby games, where you like double tap to run and keep running. Yeah, you know, it's digital, essentially.
Yeah, it might as well have been a D-pad. I couldn't see any point of it being on the 3D slider thing. So that was a bit strange. It was a bit frustrating, because it's like, am I running or walking? There's nothing in between. And linked to that, the aiming with the stylus controls, I mean, it works fine. You're kind of moving the stylus to move the cursor. It's not a real-time kind of you touch upper left and it'll shoot upper left. It's not like that. You've got to kind of slide it to the upper left.
Right, so you don't just tap and it shoots there.
Yeah, you don't tap. You have to move it like a mouse cursor to that area, which is fine when you're going like down a straight path to shoot what's in front of you. But when I got into these kind of arena sections, it was a section just before the boss, and there were these enemies kind of surrounding me, and I could shoot the ones in front of me fine, but when I wanted to turn to the right, I was moving the cursor to the right to move the camera, and it moved very, very slowly. And I was trying to get this kind of quick turn thing to work, where you kind of slide it to the right quickly.
So you do a swipe with the stylus, is that?
That was what I was instructed to do, because I was watching this kind of instruction video when I was queuing up, and I was trying to kind of remember all the controls for when I played the game. You know, I could play it you know, properly. And when I got to it, I just couldn't get it to work. I mean, I got it to work a couple of times, but I was like, what am I doing wrong? I was trying like a curved motion. I was like, a straight motion, like every motion I could think of. And it only worked like 1 out of 10 times. So what that meant was I was trying to turn and I couldn't. And I was kind of like, well, my only option was to just kind of hold it to the right and have it slowly spin around, you know?
Yeah, I wonder if that's the kind of thing that will be adjustable, because, I mean, Nintendo are not that apt to have, like, comprehensive bounding box configuration like you might find in GoldenEye or Conduit or whatever, but, I mean, Prime 3, for instance, you know, with the advanced, like, that basically is doing the same kind of adjustment. And obviously, I mean, I don't know how much they want it to feel like a shooter, but you wonder, don't you, whether they might have a configuration there.
Yeah, I would really hope so. I think I said it in my impressions. I got flashbacks of Red Steel, like, turn, for God's sake, turn.
Well, it sounds like they might have plenty of development time left in order to adjust that sort of thing. And having a public demo like this is very helpful, you know, for collecting feedback on things like
right.
that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I kind of shitted on it a lot there, didn't I? I did enjoy it. It looked good for the most part, and the aiming controls themselves were fine. It's just the turning controls that need improving.
Is there like a mix of melee combat in with the shooting or when you're on the ground?
Well, there's only one attack button. That's the L button.
Right, the trigger button.
So when enemies are near to you, he won't shoot, he will slash his sword.
So the sin of punishment.
Yes.
Comparisons continue to pile up.
Now, James, this was your first time playing 3DS at all, correct?
That's right, yeah.
Can you give us just your, you know, your initial thoughts upon seeing the screen for the first time and, you know, getting to hold it and test out the hardware?
I think Kid Icarus was actually the first game that I played. So that was my first impression of the 3DS. And it's kind of linked with Kid Icarus, my impression. The way you had to hold the 3DS for that game, Kid Icarus, you're holding it with one hand and you're aiming with your right hand. And holding the system like that, I mean, it felt great. It wasn't that heavy, apart from, well, it had a metal bolt holding it to a metal wire. That kind of, you know, added a little bit to it. But I found it difficult after a while, after a few minutes of playing, to kind of hold it steady. And then I would find the 3D sweet spot, which has been talked about a lot. I kept going out of it. So, you know, obviously your arm's getting tired and you kind of like, you can't hold it straight and you're kind of furiously moving the cursor at the same time. I think Sakurai even said this about his own game, right? He was saying, you know, people may have trouble staying in that 3D sweet spot. Try and lie the system down and on a flat surface and play like that. And I think that is going to be the way to play, because my first impression was like, this is going to be hard to keep it in 3D.
Well, I mean, I guess this would probably be true of all of us, but, you know, when we've handled 3DS, obviously we've been playing it standing up, and I just feel like it'd be a lot easier to kind of hold the spot and everything if you are sitting down.
Yeah.
So, I mean, not necessarily lying it on a coffee table or anything, just being seated, I think, will help.
Yes, I think so. Just resting on your knee or anything would be better than just...
Yeah, and certainly if you play, like, you know, with Kid Icarus has DS FPS kind of style controls to some extent, like,
right.
I know Prime Hunters was a lot more bearable when I had that extra support of a knee there,
yeah.
That's for sure.
That's a good point, yeah.
All right, so that's Kid Icarus, and I think the other big game that, you know, people would want to hear you talk about is probably Resident Evil Revelations, which is not the launch title, but it's kind of surprising that the launch title, Mercenaries, was not playable, I don't think, at the event.
That's right, Mercenaries, yeah, that was just a video. I watched the video of that, and it does look good. So yeah, Revelations, that was actually the second game that I played. I was very excited to play that because I was very surprised to actually see it there, to be honest.
Yeah.
Considering it's, you know, nowhere near completion.
Yeah, isn't that supposed to be coming out like the end of the year at the earliest?
Probably, something like that.
I think that's right. Yeah. So does it, I mean, in terms of playing it, because I've seen the interactive video before, but in terms of playing it, does it feel kind of like RE4?
Yes.
Did you get a sense of what kind of game that it is?
Yes, it's Resident Evil 4 on the 3DS. It's, yeah, it's exactly Resident Evil 4.
Wicked, man.
I was very impressed by this. So, as you'd expect from a game that's nowhere near completion, it was a very short demo. It was all on the ship that we saw in the first trailer, and it had some nice kind of weather effects outside and lightning effects and very atmospheric. I'd put the graphics around Resident Evil 4 with kind of leanings towards Resident Evil 5 kind of aesthetics, I'd guess. But basically Resident Evil 4. And when you go into the aiming mode, it's first person, because obviously having the character taking up half the screen while you're aiming wouldn't look that good on a small screen. So I think that was a good decision there. And then it's all using the 3D slider. I call it the 3D slider. What is it called? The slide pad?
The slide pad. Although I think I've seen like Japanese stuff now referring to it simply as the circle pad.
Right.
As well. They might have actually changed their mind about, maybe they thought there might be some confusion because you've got the 3D slider is what adjusts the depth of a field kind of effect. Maybe they're trying to alleviate the very verbal problem you're having.
So the circle sliding 3D pad is is the how you move and how you aim. There's no touch pad support at all.
It's not doing shooting in the same way as Kid Icarus then.
Thank God. Yeah. So that makes it even more like playing it on the GameCube, basically. Yeah.
Right, where you only use the one joystick for
exactly
moving or aiming, but never both at the same time.
That's right. And I saw a lot of other outlets complain that you couldn't move in first person, which is kind of something that they're going towards with the Resident Evil games. But I discovered that you could, by holding L and R simultaneously, you could move slowly in any direction, but it would lock your aim. So as long as you've got a good aim, you could hold down both buttons and you could backpedal and shoot that way.
Oh, nice. Well, that's new for the series, actually.
It seems appropriate for Resident Evil to be able to do that.
Yeah, it feels really good. And I hope that is a feature that they're going to keep. That wasn't some kind of accidental secret
trial balloon.
Yeah, that I just stumbled upon.
And did the game scare you?
I think I mentioned in my impressions that I did fall for the old kind of lightning, seeing your own shadow on the wall, thinking it's a monster trick.
Nice.
I did fall for that. I was wearing headphones and the volume was quite loud, so that's my excuse.
No, that's cool though that they can, you know, that they can even do that on a handheld.
Yeah, you have to play this with headphones on and in a darkened room in 3D. I think it's going to be awesome.
But only if you're over the age of 6.
Well, or 15, as the game's rating will probably tell you to.
All right. We actually got a listener mail question that is all about this 3DS stuff, and so I thought it'd be great to just bring it into this segment. So, Greg, can you read that letter that we got?
Yep, this is from Jake, a.k.a. Tanuki141, and he writes, "By now you and most of the listeners have seen the Nintendo World 2011 coverage and videos. What do you make of Nintendo not mentioning the downloadable service or handheld virtual console? Also, are you excited for Ocarina of Time 3D? When do you predict Nintendo will release this game, as they have now two Legend of Zelda games that are hopefully coming out this year? What do you think of Mario Kart 3DS and Paper Mario 3DS? Do you think both games look too similar to the other games in their respective series? And one last thing, which presentation style do you prefer for the Professor Layton series? The hand-drawn style of the first four games, or the polygonal graphics with more animation for the 3DS game?"
All right, well, we have the perfect person here to talk about these questions, because James just saw these games.
I think I can answer most of those.
Okay. Well, we have a metric for how excited you are for Ocarina of Time 3D, which is you're not willing to wait 90 minutes to play the Deku Tree.
Exactly. I wasn't willing to wait an hour and a half to play a level I played three times in 3D.
Yeah, let me say this right off the bat. You quickly referred to this before, but I am not excited for Zelda on 3DS because it's Ocarina of Time. And I love that game. We did a whole episode about that game, and it's one of our most well-known and popular episodes. So, of course, I love that game. But I played Ocarina of Time on N64 and then again on GameCube, and I played some of it on Wii as well, and I played Majora's Mask on Wii. So it's not like it's been 12 years since I played this game, and I think that goes for a lot of other people as well. I just don't know that there's this massive need in the community for, oh my god, it's time to bring back Ocarina of Time. I can't wait to play it again.
Right.
Well, I mean, I think it's probably aimed at, it's to some extent not at the diehard people so much, although, yeah, there's definitely some people that, you know, will buy that game again because they love it. I don't doubt that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, also, we can remember that was a huge commercial success relative to the N64, didn't it sell like 7 million copies or whatever? And I think it was definitely one of the games that did best in Japan. So it probably tried at, you know, the slightly more kind of casual Ocarina fans, if you like, yeah, who may well have only played it once and kind of forgotten about it. But there's still that fondness there that, you know, if you've got a new product and it, you know, prods them, they'll think, oh, you know, I'd like to play that again.
Would you guys agree if it was Wind Waker 3D, would all be on board?
Well, that game has never been re-released, and I'd be interested to see what they're going to change to it. I mean, from what I've seen, the changes that they're making to Zelda, to Ocarina, are not anything all that exciting, and the game doesn't look dramatically different than the original version. It's like with Star Fox, they seem to be making some improvements, but it still looks like an N64 game.
I mean, the biggest improvements would probably be like interface stuff, you're cleaning up issues like with the, you know, handling your inventory with like the iron boots, the hover boots and things like that. So, I mean, it's probably going to be the smoothest way to replay the game if you want to replay it, and, you know, it'll be portable, which is always nice. But the price, actually, I think could be an issue here, because what we're seeing, for at least in Japan, initially, is that there's a big range in the prices. You know, you've got Nintendogs coming out for something, you know, pretty close to what you'd expect for a DS game at 4,800 yen. But then you've got, you know, some of the premium titles coming out at over 6,000 yen. So how that translates here, you know, I mean, Ocarina for, you know, $30 is one thing, but if it's like 45... I don't know how many people are going to be that crazy for that.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to pay $30 for it. I mean, I think from Nintendo's perspective, it certainly makes business sense re-releasing that game on 3DS. And I think it will stand out, you know, among the fact that it's one of the best games ever made. It's also going to be one of probably the meatiest experiences that you're going to get on the system this year, because a lot of launch window games tend to be kind of shorter and more experimental. So, you know, having a 40-hour adventure on your brand new system is quite appealing. I get that, but at the same time, you know, they launched DS with N64 ports back in 2004, and now they're doing it again with 3DS. It's not a good way to show off your highly advanced, very expensive, brand new handheld system when you're releasing the same kinds of remakes that you were 6 years ago.
It's a little shocking that neither port is actually a launch title in Japan. I mean, the only first-party launch title in Japan coming up February 25th or whatever it is Nintendogs.
Mm.
I assume they're going to follow pretty shortly after. You might still call them kind of launch window, but, you know, they're not even padding out the actual launch with them.
Yeah.
I think it's very strange that they're using Nintendo 64 games. I mean, we've had this with the original DS.
This thing could run GameCube games.
Yeah, why isn't it Wind Waker?
Because Wind Waker didn't sell as well.
Wind Waker in 3D, that would be a first day purchase for me.
I think portability would lend itself quite well to Wind Waker, you know, because it does have some of the sailing stuff where it's kind of like switch your mind off, and that is more palatable to me in a portable setting than it is sat in front of the TV.
Right.
Yeah, it's if you're going to remake Ocarina of Time for a new system, remake it. I mean, the problem is, even though they've cleaned up a few textures and things like that, it still looks like an N64 game. And compared to things like Kid Icarus, it's not going to be a favorable comparison. So this system is so much more powerful than they're using it in this case, and I just don't think it looks that good. I mean, I saw that video back at E3. They only showed it in the, you know, highly exclusive, hard-to-get-into Miyamoto roundtable thing, and they were making a big deal like, you know, make sure you go check this out. And everybody was like, oh my god, it's Ocarina, dude. And I'm like, it's a fucking N64 game. Why are we playing this on 3DS? It boggles my mind.
Also, the Star Fox remake seems to have a lot more effort put into it. The Ocarina remake, I mean, the bosses that I saw in the videos, they did not look as good as the ones that they did in Star Fox 3D remake.
Right, so what does it see? Like, they had Goma and Dodongo, yes. King thing?
They very much looked like the Wii Virtual Console, kind of just slightly crisper, but pretty much the same. Whereas in Star Fox, they'd redone the textures, and they seem to have more, you know, polygons to them, you know, even to some of the bosses. So I just don't think they're putting as much effort into Ocarina. Maybe it's a more complex game to do that, but still.
Well, anyway, that's my bitch fest about.
I think we've killed that question. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't like ports. I don't like lazy ports, which I think this is kind of an example of. But
right.
James, let's leverage more of your experience here.
Okay.
What'd you think of the videos of Mario Kart and Paper Mario?
I only briefly saw Paper Mario. I couldn't really make a definitive opinion on that. But the Mario Kart one, which I said earlier I queued up to see, was, it's Mario Kart. It's Mario Kart 3DS.
Yeah, that was my impression when I saw that video.
It looks like the Wii game, or possibly, you know, Double Dash, somewhere in between. New tracks and 3D characters in 3D. I mean, yeah, it looks nice. We're all going to buy it, so what else can I say about it?
they're typically not that progressive with the Mario Kart franchise in terms of, you know, I mean, Double Dash was the most significant departure, and there was such a backlash against it, unfortunately, that I don't know they'll ever try anything like that again.
Right. We just got to cross our fingers that they make the online as good, or hopefully better than the Wii one.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that would be nice.
That is their premier online series. And I think that game has some of the best online on both DS and on Wii. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I certainly would hope so.
Please, God, don't screw that up.
And we don't know anything about friend codes or anything like that, the download service. They didn't really. I heard on the 8-4 podcast, they talked about this event as well. And you know, I would recommend people go check that out for some supplementary coverage, but they were talking about Xevious, and that was basically an NES game or an arcade game from the early 80s. And did you play that as well?
That was in the viewing walls section. It wasn't playable. I
actually played that back in E3.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it was playable. And that seems almost certain to either be a download game or, you know, like 3DSware. Or as part of some kind of
compilation.
Yeah, Namco compilation of classic games redone with 3D layering.
Right. Well, that would make sense. So I would say $50 cartridge then. I passed it. I had a quick look. I don't really know much about Xevious, but yeah, it was just a 2D game with the sprite slightly raised out of the screen. So what else can I say about that?
In terms of the online features, the download service, the virtual handheld, all that stuff is going to be revealed on January 19th.
Yeah, I mean, the nature of this thing, I pretty clued in from seeing your video that you made for the site, James. You know, it just seemed to me it was all about getting people to get hands on it and see it for themselves, yeah, because you have to with 3DS to kind of appreciate the technology. So it wasn't really about like revealing all these features and all this kind of stuff. It was to get the word of mouth going, start the buzz going.
Well, that just reminded me, Greg, on TV the other day, I did see my first 3DS advert on TV.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I've seen 3DS commercials via the Nintendo channel on my Japanese Wii.
Oh, right. And it's just people reacting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's awful. I really hope they've got something better lined up, like either subsequently, like this is just a teaser kind of thing and they're going to kind of blow it out later.
Yeah,
or they're going to have something better for the Western markets, because it really is. It is just Japanese people in white backgrounds looking into a 3DS going, oh!
It sounds hilarious, but maybe not effective.
No sale. That's all. Well, I'm saying.
Well, if you watch the video of the event, when I'm coming into the hall, you can see these huge giant posters of basically Japanese celebrities with their mouths open, gasping.
Yeah.
I mean, that's basically how they're selling the 3DS.
Listeners might know that I used one of those for the chapter art last week.
Yes, just a guy with his mouth open, just going, "Eh, sugoi!" That's what they say. Things like that.
And to the last question, James, did you see Professor Layton and the Mask of Miracles? And what can you say about it? And do you prefer the polygonal graphics to the classic 2D hand-drawn stuff on DS?
Well, I can't say which one I prefer. I like both at this point. I didn't play Professor Layton. I think the queue was about 60 minutes, and you only got a couple of minutes with it. So I would have said maybe just one puzzle I could have done in that. So it wasn't worth queuing an hour to do a puzzle in Professor Layton. But I did see the video in the viewing wall, and I was very, very impressed. I think the trailer was almost a minute long on the viewing wall, and I really, really like it. I like how when they're talking, you know, their mouths are moving, and obviously it's in 3D. So at the front of the screen, they're coming out of the screen, and the background's in the background. And in the kind of exploring the town section, you can pan left and right with your stylus, and it had a very nice kind of, 3D kind of parallax scrolling effect. And the characters that you can interact with were in 3D, and certain objects like post boxes and lampposts and things like that, they were in 3D and they kind of popped out at the front.
Maybe that's where the hint coins are.
Yes, they showed that in the video. He touched a lamppost and a little coin came out.
Really? So that'd be interesting if they used the 3D effect to actually give you a clue as to where you should tap to find those coins.
Yeah, that was the impression I got.
Oh, I like that idea, actually. Because as it is, it's sort of random, just jabbing all over the place.
Well, it's so static. The image, obviously, that you look at in a Layton game when you're kind of exploring is just, it's one layer. It's like a painting, really. You're just tapping. Whereas if you've got like this kind of diorama with some polygonal objects in it, it just sounds like it's, feels more like you're actually poking around something.
Yeah, it felt very much like a theater, how, the backgrounds are kind of 2D and you've got kind of layers upon that.
Layers,
and then the things on the front of the stage are actual real objects that you can, look around. It kind of felt like that. So it had a very kind of charming look to it, as you'd expect.
Of course, this is a launch title in Japan. I mean, it has no chance of being so in the West because of the localization, we must assume. But it's got to be the big one, surely. I mean, Nintendox is huge in its own way, but other than Nintendox,
it must be very frustrating for importers, because this is the game of all of them that most people would want to get, yet, ironically, the one game they will never be able to understand to play.
But the actual art style is very continuous with the original DS titles, right?
Yeah, it looks like the same style as before, but in 3D. In 3D, so, in both meanings of the word 3D.
Right, right.
But the fact they're actually doing lip syncing for the character dialogues is kind of cool use of that. Yeah, there's a functionality to go into the polygonal style there.
Yeah. And when people are talking, they're doing hand gestures and they're moving their mouths, and it feels very much more like a conversation. And like I said, when you're having a conversation, those two characters or three characters that are talking all are kind of just popping out the front of the screen.
It sounds great. Did they show many puzzles in the video? Could you get a sense of how those might look in 3D?
There was one involving penguins and pushing blocks around, but the blocks in the puzzle were kind of, standing out of the screen. But as for using the 3D as part of the puzzle, I didn't see any of that.
I doubt that they're going to do that. I doubt it. But I'm actually more interested in the fact that now they're using polygonal graphics. They're going to be able to present objects and scenes in the puzzles so much more effectively than before, that there might actually be new kinds of puzzles just based on the fact that it's running a 3D graphics engine now instead of a bunch of sprites. Okay, well,
I think we nailed that question, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So we got to wrap up this segment, but before we go, is there anything else that you kind of want to bring up that stood out to you?
Well, I saw so many 3D video demos that, I have trouble recalling all of them. But
sure.
One little thing that I did like, you guys have probably played this as well, and that was the augmented reality, the AR games, the shooting game, where you take a photo of your face and then that's put on a character in real time and then you've got to shoot it. And I just thought it was amazing how the scenery in the real world displayed on the screen was kind of being deformed and destroyed. So like, you know, as you're shooting, you kind of, there's a wall behind me, and as I shot that, you know, it put a hole in it, and then, you know, things came out of that, and I thought that was very cool.
So that augmented reality stuff is actually like loaded onto the system or whatever, and it comes with like little cards that you use.
Right, the little yellow question mark cards. They you're going to get like, I think, 5 or 6 of those with the system.
I think that's very clever marketing by Nintendo, because it's built into the system, it's easy to show off to other people. And that's a fantastic word of mouth tool.
All the 3D camera stuff and the AR stuff, that's going to be all built in. So you can have lots of fun without even buying your first game.
All right. Well, I guess my final question, James, is how excited are you now about the 3DS, having spent some time with it? And do you think you're going to be one of those people lining up overnight in the cold in late February in Japan to pick up a system?
I'm much more excited than I was before going to the event. But I don't think I'll be queuing up. I don't think there's quite enough games that I want on launch day. I think I'll wait for like Revelations or something like that.
What about just because we understand it's going to be region locked. How does that factor into your decision making?
Well, as you may know, I do have an American Wii, and that does have its downsides being in Japan, you know, not being able to buy all these cheap secondhand games here. And, you know, Greg, you're probably, you know, seething at the idea of, you know, being able to buy games for like £5 or something. And I don't buy them, and you could buy them. So I think I will go for a Japanese one this time, just so I can...
But just later on down the line.
Just later on down the line. I'm not going to pay $25,000 for it on launch day. I don't think I've ever queued up outside for a system on day one, ever. And I don't think the 3DS will be the first one to do that.
All right, cool. So... Again, thank you very much, James, for coming on the show and talking to us about this. All of your coverage is on the website, NintendoWorldReport.com, and I would really encourage people to go read up. You've got quite extensive written impressions on several of the most important high-profile games that we brought up briefly here. And you put up some awesome video of the whole event, and kind of, you know, just to give people a flavor of what was up there. There's some like live stage shows.
Yeah, that was cool.
Live Gerudo Desert theme performance. Guitar and
on
brass.
Guitar, yes.
Nice.
That was really cool.
I still need to watch that. And of course, I would remind people that on January 19th, that's the big worldwide reveal. I don't know how much more they're going to say in Japan, but in the US, we're getting, and in Europe as well, we're getting a release date, pricing info, launch lineup, and I think finally details on all the online gameplay, friend codes maybe, virtual handheld, 3DSware, all of that stuff should be finally revealed on January 19th, which is Wednesday after this show comes up, and we'll have full coverage at Nintendo World Report. Neil is attending the event in New York, and he's going to be cranking it out, and we'll have all kinds of press release announcements and things like that as well. So really be sure to check out the site all day on Wednesday the 19th and get all that info.
Cool.
All right. Well, thanks again, James. And we're going to take a break now and come back with listener mail and bring back James Jones and John Lindemann as well.
Okay. Thanks, guys. See you later.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Okay, so first off, we've got impressions from the Nintendo World event that you already heard about in the first segment. James Charlton gives us his impressions of Nintendogs plus Cats, Super Street Fighter 4 3D Edition, Biohazard Revelations, and Kid Icarus Uprising. Also, lots of other news and videos from Nintendo World, so if you were interested in what James was talking about earlier, be sure to get the more in-depth version of it on the website.
Neil has a review of Tom Clancy's Ghost Recon for Wii, which he calls a unique take on the franchise, but that might not be a good thing. Check out his review to find out.
That was developed by the guys who made Punch-Out and also Mario Strikers.
Yeah, we covered that last week.
Yeah,
not,
we did.
Not a good thing.
Carly has impressions of Bit Trip Flux. It's the last Bit Trip game and tells us what to expect. Is it more of the same? Find out with the impressions.
All right. Our own James Jones, the beloved James Jones, has a review of Ghost Trick for Nintendo DS. And he tells us whether or not this game is amazing, incredible,
yes.
Just really, really good. No. Check out his review to see whether or not you should buy this game right now.
Yes.
Or in a few hours.
No, now. I don't care if the stores are closed. Now.
And we have a review of Art Academy by Matt Blunden, and it's the retail version of the DSiWare games that came out a little while ago. And so is the retail edition better than the DSiWare ones? Is it worth the extra money? Find out with his review.
Finally, reviews, we have Zach's take on Need for Speed Hot Pursuit for Wii. He tells us whether or not this Wii version of Hot Pursuit holds its own against his HD brothers. Check out his review to see if you'll feel the need for speed.
Yes! Yes!
I feel you. I feel me.
What is this, the front line to Keanu Reeves movies?
It just
come
made my day. The thing is, I knew Greg would read it because he appreciates it. He appreciates it, James.
You don't know, the listeners don't know how many times I've had to edit out me saying, go fuck yourself, San Diego, from this segment. And finally, we have James' blog called The Iwata Ambush, ominously, in which James provides us with a very important public service announcement regarding the newest health threat to developer press conferences, the sudden appearance of Satoru Iwata.
There's also something about the last story. In
it. Yeah, but that is in no way life-threatening and therefore irrelevant.
All right, so be sure to check out all this great original content over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to the show. It's time for listener mail. It's been a couple of weeks since we got into your emails, and we've been getting a lot of really good ones over the holidays. It's time to catch up. I've got 6 letters picked out here. Hopefully we're going to get to all of them. Okay, I've got the first letter. It's from Dave. Hey, RFN crew. On a recent show, I recall Greg and Johnny chatting about a paucity of PSN friends. I just wanted to send in my own PSN name that you can add to your friends list. Synaptic, which is SYN4APTIK. He says, this is also my NWR forums name. Any of your listeners can also add me. I think Nintendo fans are much more interesting gamers than the dude bro knuckleheads that I run into randomly while playing online multiplayer, so I would love to befriend the NWR community, both listeners and staff. There you go. If you're on PSN, add Synaptic. Note the spelling. That's SYN4, the number 4, APTIK. I've already added him.
Yeah, me too. As I said a bit last week, I've padded my PSN list quite a lot now.
Yeah.
Pandarius has got some silly, scary Pac-Man scores.
I think I have Pandarius too. And actually, I think I mentioned it before, but the Facebook page is a good place to post these. That way it's in text and everybody can see it. Or use our forums, of course.
Yeah, we have forums. The General Gaming sub-forum, there is a floated folder called the Xbox Live PSN, etc. Online Name Thread Index.
All right. So anyway, we are happy to spread the good word about Synaptic's username. And again, we probably won't be reading any other emails like this on the show, but there are places you can post these things, and we'll find it, and other people will find it as well. And I agree. I mean, these are friends lists, so sometimes it might feel weird to add someone who you don't really know just because they're in the same community. But consider you probably already have a lot in common with the people who would be on that community. And so you're probably going to get, if you do end up playing a game online together, you're probably going to get on with them better than you would random people.
Or is here first them, the dude bro knuckleheads.
Mm-hmm.
Like John.
I'm not a knucklehead.
Dude bro, yes. Knucklehead, no.
Okay, James, you've got the next email.
Thomas from England writes, I've been re-listening to some older episodes of RFN this week, and 2 things stuck with me. A while back, Greg mentioned that he saw a lot of untapped potential in the horror in video games. On a more recent episode, Johnny stated that the importance of sound design is commonly overlooked in game development. I thought it was interesting to pair these 2 points together, because if there's one genre where good sound design seems to be vital to the experience, it's horror. It got me thinking about the comparison between horror movies and survival horror games. In a film, perhaps it's conveyed better, as you can ensure the viewer sees and hears certain things so it unsettles them. Whereas in a game, because of the extensive control the player generally has, it is harder for the game to catch you out. And even when something unnerves you successfully, you can usually do something to make it stop in a way that you obviously could never do watching a film. Consider that a game design challenge of sorts. After all, sometimes the consumer has a better idea of what will work than the developer. I feel it's a valid argument that horror has never been exploited in this medium all that well. So what techniques do you think could be employed to create a really effective horror in video games? Or maybe I should be asking, is it possible to do horror well in this format, considering that the extent to which it spooks someone is subject to individual differences?
I think one of the things that horror games do poorly is the fact that they completely lead you down a path where you know something is going to jump out.
The RE effect?
It's like, oh wow, there's a window over there and I just know something is going to jump in. Oh, it's dogs. Great. It's really not that scary.
That's the shock horror version of it. Like, yeah. Like in Resident Evil, or the original one, in the mansion. There's this corridor on the outside of the mansion pretty early in the game where it's just a wall of windows. And the first time you go down there, you're like, I know one of these windows is going to get busted.
Yeah, it's like there's no zombies in the hallway. Or maybe yes. There's one way at the other end.
And the hallway is long as hell.
Yep.
And it gives you some completely strange camera angle that you know it's like these are windows. Look at them. They're made of glass. Glass is really fragile.
See, I don't think that stuff is scary in movies either.
Yeah.
I've seen very few movies in my life that I would consider truly scary, and I don't know that I've ever played a video game that I would consider truly scary. And I'm not saying that I cannot be scared, that I'm super macho. I just think it's usually done very clumsily, and it could be done a lot better and more effectively. And I think in movies as well as games, I'm a lot more impressed by creepiness, you know, the more atmospheric stuff. And I think games are just as capable of being creepy as a film is, because the ways that movies are creepy or can be creepy really aren't mitigated by the translation to the video game format. Things like an oppressive or really off-kilter type soundtrack, because music doesn't need to be interactive. So you can I just played a game this week, a computer game called Eversion, and I don't know what I think about it yet because I've got issues with the controls. It's basically like a really cute Mario-style 2D platformer. And yet, as you go through the game, you keep kind of you keep activating these effects that make the world kind of darker and a little bit more twisted each time. And it's kind of like you keep diving one layer deeper and deeper and deeper into madness, so that basically it keeps like stripping away layers of cuteness until... I've heard it described as an all-out horror game, which seems extremely unlikely when you first boot it up. And really all it's doing is the graphics change ever so slightly, and it's mainly done in the music. And the music does become sort of more unsettling. And even in games like Resident Evil 2, which I'm not a fan of really as a game, but I do love the soundtrack. I think the soundtrack is superbly creepy.
The soundtrack's really good. It walks the line between evoking those cheesy zombie films that obviously it's, you know, aping, but the soundtrack's actually legitimately good at the same time, rather than just being cheesy and rubbish. It's really perfectly kind of balanced.
The thing is, where I think the RE games fall down sometimes is they've kind of removed that random element. Like, to me, like, the scariest part of any game, and this can really be any game, I mean, an action game or anything like that, is where, like, when you don't know, when you know that you're going to be chased by something, but you don't know where it's coming from, you don't know when, and you know that it will kill you. Like, you have to move as soon as it comes in.
You should play some roguelikes, because that's how they feel all the way through.
Yeah, well, that's a really old-school kind of concept. I mean, all the way going back to, like, Berserk
and
stuff like
that. It is a problem,
that.
I think, you know, you look at the way game design's going. Yeah, obviously, yeah, the fidelity of the graphics and the sound and what you can do, atmosphere much more effectively, much more creepy. But the way game design's going tends to be to explain everything more and more, you know, to lay it out, like, this is what you need to do, each give a boat, you know, on-screen prompts, quick time events, all this kind of stuff. To me, what the horror would probably come from, and this is true in a film as well, is when you don't know what's going on. That sort of confusion and panic of something that you're not quite sure what to do. And the problem is, in a game setting, it may be a feeling that, you know, that just could be frustrating for people. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't like it. You know, I mean, you did kind of run into this some extent, I think, like with what some people said about sort of the latter nightmare sequences in Silent Hill Shattered Memories, that, like, how the hell just to get out of some of those things kind of became really difficult to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, those sequences in Shattered Memories are very stressful, but I wouldn't call them scary. They're intense and they're difficult, and sometimes they're very frustrating. And they do make it stressful because you're so powerless, and very few games are willing to put you in that kind of situation. And so I admire that game for trying something that's kind of unusual, but I don't think it makes the game scarier than it normally would be. I actually much prefer the non-action parts of that Silent Hill game on the Wii when you're just walking around, because I found that to be really interesting. I think I mentioned this when I first talked about it, but you know that you can't be hurt in these sequences.
Yeah.
I mean, you may not know that when you first start playing the game, but very quickly it becomes apparent that, you know, you're in no danger of losing or anything like that. There's no gameplay consequence. And to me, that frees up the game designers to make it just as creepy as possible, because they know that you won't try to play it conservatively. And that's the problem when a game like, say, Resident Evil is trying to be really scary, and you know that it's trying to make you feel like you're in danger. My reaction to that, and I think most people's reaction to that, is to stock up on more ammo and stock up on more typewriter ink tapes and whatever you think you're going to need to survive. So it turns you into a survivor. And because of that, it really makes the game less scary, because you go through all these steps. Whereas in Shattered Memories, I felt like I wanted to go find all that scary stuff because I knew it wouldn't cause me to lose the game or anything. So I would actually seek that stuff out, and I really liked it, how they did it.
So to me, at least my most recent experience goes back to Fragile Dreams, which does a lot of oppressive environmental stuff. There's not a lot of moments where you're truly freaked out by the game, because it's not really that kind of game. There's no jump out scares. The game warns you ahead of time when you're about to be attacked by something. And it's not through some on-screen HUD or anything. It's that, by and large, the game is just silent, which itself is, for a game, is kind of creepy. I mean, basically all you hear is you walking and it echoing.
Yeah, there's some of that in Dead Space too. But I always got the sense that Fragile Dreams was more, it was supposed to be more melancholy than creepy.
Well, there are moments of melancholy, like, and there's moments where it's just downright unsettling. So there's a long sequence where you go to one of these underground shopping arcades that exist in Japan. They're usually attached to train stations, which is the case here. Mm-hmm. And the roof is really low because it's underground, and you're basically going through these closed shopping quarters, and it's storefronts with the big like garage door fronts that close. So they're all closed, and they're all just run down, and they've been painted on by people. And the walls are very tight. There's a lot of echo from you walking. There's no music. There's no enemies to speak of for the majority of the walking. But it's incredibly dark, and it just feels like it's super tight corridors. But when you get close to something, you can actually start to hear it in the Wii remote before you start hearing it on the TV. Then you start to hear it on the TV when you get like right on top of it. And that's really unnerving, because you're just walking and then suddenly you hear something, you're like, oh, what is that? I don't know what that noise is. And there's one particular enemy that always got me, because the noise that comes out of the Wii remote is this really sharp cackle. And those enemies are just freaking evil. But when you hear it, you're like, oh God, no. And the problem is, Seto himself is not good in combat, so you feel pretty freaking weak with these things. But when you finally get out of this shopping arcade, which goes on forever, it's a big underground maze, essentially, and most of the stuff looks the same, with just different levels of dilapidation. And at one point, they actually have you go into the old part of the shopping arcade, which is even tighter, and you're like, oh God, it's worse. And when you finally get out of it, it takes you out to this like brilliant sunset over a field, and you're like, this is the most amazing place I've ever been. And then you start walking, and the game tells you, yeah, you have to go back down in there. You're like, no, I don't want to go back in there again.
Yeah, I mean, contrast, I think, is important.
Yeah.
And this goes for films as well. But games, and you could put the Resident Evils in this kind of category, where it's pretty much like it's always moody, and you know, it's like a dangerous place, or this, that, you kind of become desensitized to it inevitably.
I think the first Dead Space, that was a real problem.
Yeah,
because it felt like there was no up and down.
There's no like verdant pasture that you get to go to in that game to kind of have spend a nice half an hour
stepping out into this pretty much gorgeous sunset or sunrise. I'm not sure exactly what it was. This empty field. I think there's a cat that comes by too when you're over there.
It's always the sign of impending doom.
It's really relaxing. You're like, I'm out. I'm finally safe. This is great. And then when it tells you at the end of the field you have to go back in, enemies have appeared on the field, so you're dreading already having to go back, and then as you're walking back, you're being attacked. It's like, I hate you, game.
Well, James, I'm glad you mentioned the Wii Remote speaker, because I think that has been used pretty effectively on the system for horror games. And, I mean, I guess, you know, different games use it different ways to varying degrees of success, but the nice thing about it is it goes back to the original sort of buzz phrase that Nintendo was throwing around when they first revealed that feature, which is depth of sound. And unfortunately, I think in terms of actual depth of sound, the Wii Remote speaker has rarely been used well. But in a horror game, it's nice if there's a specific sound effect that they really want you to notice. It's kind of nice when they can play it that much closer to your ear. And it has a different timbre because of the shitty hardware. And sometimes they, and I think that especially in horror games, they can actually use that to their advantage.
Well, I like it with Silent Hill again, because you get like when those nightmare creatures are surrounding you and stuff, like you get that staticky kind of noise, which obviously, yeah, you know, makes plenty of sense. It's been in Silent Hill before, and with there's that whole artifice of like the home movies theme kind of going on when you die, you know, when mm-hmm. you fail, you know, it just kind of goes to the fuzzy white noise kind of thing. So they made it work, and that the low fidelity is kind of part of the aesthetic of the world in a way. So they made it work for them in that case. But it obviously limits what you can do with it.
Any final thoughts before we move on?
On the as obviously, because I set this in motion, my past self, I still feel that you could totally do very effective horror in games and effective in a different way than you can in films because of the, you know, interactivity of it. But it's difficult because you can't have the sort of scripted. I mean, obviously, cutscenes you can, but in terms of that particular quality of games, it'd be scary because it's interactive. The problem that has with it is it can't be as specifically directed as a film, you know, and even the soundtrack, you know, the soundtrack isn't going to be as each particular note is going to coincide with a particular action. It's not as just meticulously put together to scare you. So it's a problem in that sense, but there's a lot of opportunities as well. And I think, like I said, the problem I think, this goes with films as well, is that, you know, if you've got something that's just one note that is a horror game or it's a horror movie, it generally isn't that scary. I mean, I think if you could get to a point where you have games that are telling adult stories effectively, they can have moments of horror that are very effective. That's where I think we're getting to eventually. I mean, for me, some of the scariest things I've ever seen or experienced watching a film is stuff in David Lynch films, which are not horror films at all.
Yeah.
See, I'm glad you said that, because I was just thinking part of the reason that I'm not impressed by horror movies or horror games is that I think, you know, throwing these grotesque monsters and things like that in there are, it doesn't matter how realistic it looks. I mean, you know, we've got Uncanny Valley issues in video games, but even in movies, mm-hmm. you know, even if it's shot with camera and makeup effects, it's just not that convincing. I'm a lot more impressed and affected by movies in which normal-looking people do horrifying things, or sometimes it's just that you know something horrible is going to happen to a character that you like, and there's nothing you can do about it. And unfortunately, in gaming, that's more difficult to do because of the interactivity, you would expect that you could actually do something about it. Whereas in a film, they can really take advantage of that helpless, passive relationship between you and the medium.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the problem. I mean, I think just in a game, you have to provide that interactivity, or you're really not providing any more experience than they would have watching a film. You're actually providing an inferior experience.
I think it needs to be done in a completely different way than in film, but I don't know exactly what that would be.
Like I said, I think those to me are some of the key elements. You know, like, you have to be willing to, at those particular times, like I said, if this is a game that's not, you know, a constant barrage of monstrosities and horror, maybe you can get away with just saying, you know, for this one scene or a couple of scenes, let the player be confused as to what they need to do, and let that be part of the terror, you know, which you wouldn't get in a film. You know, you might be confused as to what's going on, but there's never any question about what you need to do, because you're not doing anything.
Yeah.
Right.
Whereas I think that could be really, you know, that's where you could tap into another level of psychological horror in the player, if you could get that sort of sense of panic, you know, where a player has perhaps been conditioned by the rest of the game to have a sense of surety about what they're meant to do in given circumstances, and then you take it away.
Sure. Well, you see that in Eternal Darkness with the insanity effects. You know, I think we've talked about it before, obviously in Retroactive, but I think Eternal Darkness did a lot of very forward-thinking, sort of ahead-of-its-time ideas in terms of, you know, they do things like, all of a sudden your head pops off. Well, what am I supposed to do now? And the truth is, you can't do anything. You just have to wait for the effect to go away.
Yeah.
But the player sort of panics, because all of a sudden it's like, wait, did I do something wrong? You know, and there's a lot of stuff like that, where blood starts running down the screen. You're like, is something wrong with my TV? You know, and then it says your memory card's been erased, and there's a lot of great stuff like that. And unfortunately, with Eternal Darkness, and we talked about this before, but all those things are so transient that eventually you become conditioned to ignore them when something really weird starts happening. And also, because of the artifice of having this green sanity meter, you always kind of know when something like that's about to happen, or usually. And so I think they were thinking in the right direction, and it just didn't quite go all the way to make it super effective, because they still kind of needed to work it all into this formulaic gameplay structure. But I'd like to see more experimentation with stuff like that. I played the Dead Space 2 demo this week, and there's an insanity sequence in that demo, and I expect there'll be a lot more in the full game. But yeah, I don't know that they've solved that problem. I kind of doubt it.
Again, I mean, I think going into something like Dead Space 2, and I'm not saying that it can't be thrilling in its own way, you know, but in terms of genuinely scary, you're just going to be steeled before
you play that game as a shooter, and, you know, I like the exploration of it. I like the action of it. I'm not playing it because I like to be scared. I could do without that. I honestly could do without a lot of the monsters and zombies and grotesque shit.
I could actually do without any of the enemies. I'd just like to be a nice stroll through through a space station.
Well, I remember playing Half-Life 2, and I got so sick of the fucking zombies and head crabs all over the place. I mean, the goal is to make the player feel an intense reaction to what's going on and to be kind of stressed out. And I don't really enjoy that experience. It's not that I want my games to be super easygoing and casual all the time.
Gordon Freeman goes for a walk.
I didn't feel like that game had a whole lot else to offer. And there's really no contrast, as we talked about earlier. So I'm just sick of games trying to scare me when it's clearly not going to work. Because the reaction that I have, instead of being scared, the reaction I have is, ugh. I just don't like that stuff. But anyway, it's a big topic. I hope we did some justice to it for Thomas, but John has the next letter.
All right. Nathan from Toronto writes, "My letter today was just to drop you a line on some of my thoughts regarding my Christmas haul of games. I'm currently playing through Kirby's Epic Yarn and Donkey Kong Country with the wife, and she loves them. Yes, Johnny, she does have a sister, and no, you can't date her."
I should point out this letter was clearly written before last week's episode.
She have a brother.
Surprisingly, she didn't
name John Lindemann.
She didn't enjoy New Super Mario Bros. Wii, but there is just something about those installments that brings out the inner platformer in her. This, to say the least, has been fantastic fun, and I can't say I've enjoyed so many games in quick succession before. I'm loving the fact that, unlike in many previous DKCs, this one actually headlines Donkey Kong and lets you play him throughout the game. Actually, due to Diddy Kong's floating getting in the way of jumping off of enemies, he can sometimes float when all you want to do is bounce on an enemy for more air. I find myself sacrificing the chimp to use DK in the bonus K levels to quell the frustration. I just love the weight he has to him. I'm truly hoping to see Retro do a new IP next, but in case that's not on the table, I'd love to see them take a crack at Star Tropics. Any ideas on what you'd like to see Retro come up with next?
Before we get into that, a word on Donkey Kong. First off, I do plan to go back to it. I know I'm not that big on DKCR, but I do want to finish it. And I wanted to tell Nathan that even though you couldn't play as Donkey Kong in DKC 2 or 3, you do play as him and only him in Donkey Kong Jungle Beat. And although it's not co-op, if you really like playing as Donkey Kong and you want another fantastic game where you get to play as Donkey Kong, buy a set of Jungle Beat with the bongos somewhere and plug it into your Wii. It is an amazing game that not very many people played, and I personally like it a lot better than Returns.
I would too, but I wouldn't say that to the diminishment of Returns. It's just that Jungle Beat is so individual. There's not a game that I've played that's satisfying in the same way, because it is like a platform game that is controlled in an unorthodox fashion with the bongos, which, you know, again, I've talked about this with stuff like Drilldozer and Barnet Commando, where you're kind of doing kind of usual platform stuff in a completely different way. It's mm-hmm. something that kind of appeals to me a lot, learning that new kind of platform language, but also the score system to it. I like score games, and the way the whole, you know, you have to combo, and the way the level design just kind of opens up to you when you realize like how everything's laid out so that you could maintain these crazy combos and rack up ridiculous scores and everything. It's a multi-layered game, and I like that a lot. DKCR is obviously more straightforward, but I think it's really good at what it does.
Yeah, I just want to throw that out there. If you do really like Donkey Kong, you should go check out Jungle Beat.
He's way more of a badass than Jungle Beat. He like rips things' tongues out and stuff. He's more like King Kong.
Yeah, he's the King of Kings.
Does that make him like Jesus or something?
Exactly.
I'm sorry, I should explain this reference. It was on the Japanese box art for Jungle Beat, which I have.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I've got that. You're right.
They call him the King of Kings, which would not fly in the West. it's one of those things where it's like, why do you even have an English slogan for this on the box if you don't know?
Oh, God, I completely forgot that I have the Japanese version as well. I remember finding that funny.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the reason it's on there is because English looks cool.
Mm.
They probably recognize the word king. It's probably a word they would know. The reference King of Kings, they probably don't know. Because
right.
There isn't exactly a huge Christian community.
They just thought it would look cool. But yeah, they basically refer to Donkey Kong as the Messiah on the box.
DK is bigger than Jesus, literally.
What do you guys want to see Retro do next?
Not this
first-person shooter.
Can we make predictions? I want to see that happen again.
Well, Star Tropics is a really interesting suggestion from Nathan, because that is a game that has no cachet whatsoever in Japan. It wasn't even released in Japan. And yet, Retro is an American development studio, and their games, certainly Metroid Prime games, weren't really popular in Japan anyway. So, you know, Star Tropics seems unlikely a franchise for Nintendo to really push for a reincarnation. But then again, if they want something specifically for the American audience, like they did for, say, Excitebots, apparently.
only for the American audience, period.
But if they wanted something specifically for America, it might make sense to put their top American studio in charge of it. I think something like Nintendo Software Technologies in Seattle is more likely, even though we don't really know what the hell's up with those guys.
Donkey Kong March of the Minis, Part 4.
It seems all they make is Mario versus Donkey Kong anymore. But
see, I'm not sure that it really has that big of a, you know, its name is really all that big in the U.S. either. I mean,
I think it's about as well-remembered as something like Kid Icarus. Maybe somewhat less because it came out later in the system's life.
It's not as well-remembered as Kid Icarus. There's no way.
No, it's not.
Well, it's too bad because it's a far better game.
The quality of the game is not the point at all.
I know.
I mean, it's surprising to me that they did bother to try and trade off the name of Kid Icarus with Uprising. So if you're going to say Star Tropics to me,
well,
no way.
Kid Icarus isn't all that surprising, though, because it's been predicted for like the last 6 years, and I think that created its own little hype machine around it.
I think IGN might be the number one reason that game's been made.
It's probably true. And number two is probably Brawl.
Yeah, you get the references to Smash Brothers, wasn't he? In like the Captain N cartoon and, you know, I mean, it's just much more woven into like the kind of pop culture, if you like, of Nintendo.
It's true, yeah. It's too bad Star Tropics hasn't been revisited in that way, because it's actually, if you go back and play Star Tropics, and it's $5 on Virtual Console, you really should. If you like the original Legend of Zelda, Star Tropics is a really interesting sort of twist on that, and a little bit of an evolution too. I love Star Tropics, I've talked about it before, but I do think, even gameplay aside, I think we could assume that the gameplay would be quite different if they ever went back to that franchise.
It would almost have to be.
Yeah, because it's a distinctly 2D experience in the beginning, the way the puzzles are designed and everything.
The only way they could get away with it being like that would be a download title.
Yeah, or a portable, maybe.
Probably not on the 3DS.
Yeah, not anymore. But Star Tropics takes place in a really curious world that could actually be worth revisiting. I mean, it's in this sort of tropical setting, which Nintendo has gone to occasionally with, you know, Mario Sunshine and things like that. But the way people speak is very idiosyncratic and funny. And I think that is, you know, kind of worth revisiting maybe a little bit. And the whole sort of pulpy nature of the story, where you've got, you know, people being kidnapped, you've got UFOs, you've got sea travel, a lot of weird jokes and things like that, references to, like, ancient cultures. I just like the style of Star Tropics. I mean, it's clearly made by Japanese people who are kind of totally just taking shots in the dark at what Americans might think is cool. And because of that, it has this weird flavor, because it's not actually cool, but because of that, it is kind of cool. Because it's trying, and yet...
It's Cobra, is what you're telling us.
No, it's not like that.
I mean, the Funhouse Mirror kind of element to it reminds me of Tsuda, actually.
No More Heroes, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But I mean, in the case of No More Heroes, though, he was willingly being off.
Yeah.
More self-aware.
Yeah. He wasn't just like, I think they're into this. It was like... he basically made a parody of how American culture is viewed in Japan.
I just think, you know, Star Tropics is one of the few sci-fi games that Nintendo's made outside of, you know, next to Star Fox, basically. And it takes a very different approach to sci-fi than Star Fox does. It's a unique setting. I really like it. I would love for them to go back to it, but I'm with James that if they ever did it, both for probably gameplay design reasons as well as market, you know, realities, it would probably be a very small game, like a download title. That would be fine with me. I would love that.
Yeah.
I don't really think retro, because anything retro does, it's going to be a major production. I mean, we've seen that. It doesn't look likely that retro is going to go to handheld development or WiiWare development or anything like that. So I don't see them doing Star Tropics, but I think that would be cool. And it would make sense given the American connection.
I think for us to even make hopes on what retro is making will only break our hearts in the end anyway.
Yeah, well, I mean, the point is now, when you've had the Prime games and you've had DKC, that opens a pretty huge kind of range of the kinds of games.
Well, I mean, I think really the only place they're going to go, it's going to be Wii Music 2, Greg.
Guys, I've got an idea. Wii Music 3. We're going to skip 2.
The only thing you could say about it is that they have only handled existing Nintendo properties. So the idea of them doing a new IP, and it seems like maybe, you know, with Donkey Kong Country, I wouldn't say it seems like they got more autonomous, if you know what I mean. So
right.
I struggle to see them breaking out and doing a game in a new IP that's really kind of off the Nintendo reservation. I think that DKC makes that much less likely a prospect.
That was
mind.
Almost like a flag being placed there by Spanish conquistadors. You are a Nintendo house, damn it.
Yeah.
This is what you make. You make 2D platformers, because we already have one coming out this year. Put one out last year.
Yeah, maybe the new Yoshi game we're all expecting will actually come from Retro instead of Goodfeel. Oh. It could happen, seriously.
I'd be up for Retro taking on any of the poor franchises at this point. Yoshi, Star Fox, F-Zero, I'd be willing to let them try a racing game.
Yeah, sure. I'd love to see that. Okay, and Greg has the next letter.
Okay, this one is from Danny McL in England, and he writes, "Right, I have a problem with Nintendo of Europe being a load of lazy dungheads. They can't be asked to do anything. They also make everything over here so fucking expensive. For example, Amazon USA has the DSi in black for $149.99, which is about £97, while Amazon UK has the same DSi in black for £114.50, which is about $176. You could get Fluidity or Hydro Venture for that difference in price. Why the hell is it screwed up so much? You'd think they would be roughly similar. The shipping costs can't be that different, can they? The weird thing is, if the 3DS hits the sweet spot-ish at $275, it will only be £20 more than when the DSi XL hit the shelves at £160, which over here is pretty damn reasonable. Your thoughts, guys?
I would say customs, taxes, and cost of living would be...
The big difference is value-added tax here. VAT,
yeah.
Or sales tax.
Yeah.
Now, sales tax in America varies by state, yes?
Yes.
Right.
And it's not included in the price.
No.
Here, prices take account of VAT. And in fact, VAT just recently went up 2.5 percentage points from 17.5 to 20 as part of the new government's fiscal adjustment plans. So even more of the price now is going to the government as value-added tax. So that 20% is pretty much in line with the rest of the countries in Europe. But, I mean, even America...
20% sales tax is about twice the maximum you would find anywhere.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
It's very much like in Canada where, in Canada it's the same thing. They have, I think now the entire country has like a 13% tax on everything. But right. the big thing up there is, and games do cost more up there, I think.
Which is crazy since Canada pays for the development of those games.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure they cost more, but the thing is up there is you get tariffs at customs. Like I remember when I used to live up there, if I would order something online, I would have to go to the post office and pay like a random customs charge. Like, yeah, you have to pay $10.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Nintendo in Europe, they have the actual where they print the discs and everything is in Germany, which, of course, is in the EU. So there's no trade barriers or anything that add to the price in the UK from that point of view. But yeah, obviously, having that 20% VAT built into the price explains a pretty big part of that disparity.
And yet... I did have an editor's note in here that apparently UK retailers are currently taking 3DS pre-orders at £299, including the tax. So with a 20% tax, that's about £250, which is still far more than $250.
Which is like $375 roughly. I mean, the thing is, though, is that I would imagine those pre-orders are just... because they don't know the price yet. Obviously, there's the events going on in Amsterdam and New York a few days after this will go up. And they just want to go high. Because the thing is that if you go lower than the actual price ends up being and you've taken that pre-order, you've got to stick to it, probably. Or you at least get a lot of complaints if you've undershot it and you've said they could have it for that price and then Nintendo's price is higher than you thought. Whereas if you go high, there's nothing to stop you bringing it back down. So I would have thought that's just them being careful about not to underestimate the price, and that's what, because there is no way it's going to be £300. You know, I mean, £200 I think is going to be the minimum, especially with the VAT going up, which is pretty expensive. I mean, I had my PS3 for a little bit over that.
Yeah, I think it's curious that, and this is maybe tangential, but I've been thinking lately that, you know, you hear people discuss the 3DS and they say it. You know, they're talking about the graphics, and I think they're being complimentary when they say that it looks kind of like PSP graphics. And I think, you know, the PSP came out, what, 5-6 years ago? So we're paying for the same level of graphics that PSP had 6 years ago, and we're probably paying more than we would have back then. Not that graphics are my primary concern, but I think it really feeds into the argument that, yo, 3DS is overpriced.
Yeah,
and of course the main difference there is Nintendo's taking a profit on 3DS, whereas Sony took a loss on the PSP.
That is the difference, I guess. I mean, it's interesting, the 3DS situation, as it seems now quite clear. We don't know the price yet, obviously. So I mean, we'll see how much it is. But all the indications are that it's going to be $250 at a minimum in America.
Oh yeah,
it may be more than that. But it seems like they are going to, you know, cross the Rubicon, as it were, of their rules of Nintendo portables: battery life and price. The battery life numbers are not what you expect from a Nintendo portable.
No.
It seems like the top whack that you'll get out of the 3DS with the 3D effect turned on at all is 5 hours. Mm-hmm. And you've got to charge it for 3 odd hours to get to that point.
And it pretty much guarantees that we'll see a 3DS Lite down the road.
Oh, if that were not guaranteed already.
But, yeah.
I mean, is that going to affect me personally, the way I play? No. You know,
yeah,
but it's interesting to me that they are, you know, the price is going to be bigger than they've ever charged for a portable, you know, especially relative to the consoles of the day. It's way higher than any Nintendo portable's been before.
We're talking at least $100 more than DS was back in 2004. DS launched at $150, and people said that was too high, which it probably was for that technology at the time. But 3 to 5 hours battery life, 3 hours of charge, that's about in line with what the PSP was when it first came out. The difference being that PSP had a spinning disk drive.
Yeah.
But I do think PSP2 rumors are hot and heavy these days, and it sounds like it's going to be announced a little more than a week after the 3DS event on the 19th. So we're PSP2 is supposedly being revealed January 27th with more coming at GDC. And it sounds like it might be out holiday 2011. If that thing is as powerful as the PS3, which I really doubt, but that's apparently what Sony's kind of throwing out there to developers.
I told you it's going to be closer integrated.
Because it's the same system, but smaller.
Well, certainly you would expect it to be closer to PS3 than the current PSP, which is already pretty powerful.
Yeah.
And if Sony launches that thing at like $299, it looks kind of bad. I mean, it makes 3DS look like a bad deal.
Depending on what PSP can do. I mean, the problem with PSP2 is that I don't see any real hook for that. There's nothing really that interests me about it. Like, if all it is just a beefier PSP, that's cool in Japan where, like, you just release Monster Hunter 4 and sell a zillion of them. But over here, it's like, you know, I'm buying the 3DS not because really so much for the hardware, but really just to see what they do with that 3D effect.
Well, and the software that you know it's going to have the software support. And I think that's a huge issue for PSP2, because if it is as powerful as the PS3, if I was Sony, I wouldn't be telling anybody that. That's going to scare the shit out of developers who are worried about their development costs.
And you probably can't port PS3 games to it because they take up the whole Blu-ray disc.
Yeah.
Unless they
well, they have Blu-ray UMD, so.
Good lord! I mean, Nintendo, you know, is going to be way out in front of that in terms of how quick they get to the market, and they've got just the so simple, succinct hook of 3D without glasses, and then they've got Nintendox, you know, new Super Mario Brothers, all the stuff that's, you know, eventually going to come out, and the stuff that's already confirmed, and the third parties are there. I mean, it's formidable in many ways, but it just, as a philosophical point, they have deviated from what they've stuck to and what has served them very well since 89 when they released the Game Boy. It'll be interesting to see how that part of it plays out. As I said last week, I think it is because it's more of a console-like device, really, and it's probably born out of this weird situation that you've got in Japan as well, where handhelds are becoming the console of choice. And so it kind of makes more sense there to make a handheld that's more console-like. But how well will that play everywhere else? We'll see.
Well, if I can make a prediction.
Oh, no.
You know, if 3DS launches in March at $250... and PSP2 is out in November for $300, we might be looking at a price drop for 3DS, like, down to $200 this year, like, within 6 months.
The problem with that is that you're thinking like Sony. That's exactly what Sony's saying, and they're fucking wrong.
The other thing is, this is something we've talked about before. I, in general terms, am more expectant of a price drop quicker on 3DS than we've seen with Wii and DS, because those systems were so popular and did so well that they probably felt like they could have gone higher and they didn't. So this time they may feel like we'd rather start high and work our way down than feel like we just pissed money away because we didn't have the balls to put the price where it should have been.
Sure. I mean, hasn't Reggie said, I wish we'd sold Wii for $300?
If he hasn't said it, he's thought it a lot.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the way that thing was going crazy. Anyway, we got really far away from the original question about why things cost more, but
what I will say though is that in many ways the comparisons, VAT aside, the comparisons between specifically UK pricing and America pricing actually don't look as bad as they did before the financial crisis, because the pound was worth very much more relative to the dollar back then. So these currency comparisons, for instance, that Danny makes with the DSi would have looked a lot worse back then. But the thing is that there's a certain stickiness there. You know, they can't just say, oh, well, because the pound's lost value, let's increase the cost of games from, you know, 35 quid to 40 straight off the bat, you know, because they still have to respect British market conditions and what British people earn and the standard of living and stuff.
And what they expect to pay for things, regardless of what the currency exchange market looks like.
Exactly. So this is one of the ways in which Nintendo has, as we constantly hear about from them in their financial reports, has lost money due to the fluctuations of the foreign exchange market, is because, in effect, we are getting sort of a better deal than we were before when the pound was worth $2. So Nintendo can't just click their fingers and make up that disparity, you know, like, for instance, like the virtual console points. Like, I remember thinking, like, okay, so in America, 1,000 points is $10. And then over here, it was £7. Now, at the time, the exchange rate would have led you to believe that that was a ripoff. Now it looks like a good deal. So, you know, that's how it's changed since. So it really, right now, I wouldn't say is that bad, actually, especially when you consider the tax stuff. So I wouldn't complain too much about it.
Okay, well, it's time for the next email. It's from Billy in San Jose, California, and he writes, I always was curious to know about whatever thoughts, reflections, or impressions any of you guys have on the Resident Evil games. If I am not mistaken, this is the most successful franchise for Capcom. I really have enjoyed the games ever since Resident Evil 2 on the N64. They were freaking scary when I was back in middle school, and it was a pleasant surprise playing the totally different RE4 for GameCube. Just wondering if you had any discussion about the subject. Also, Sonic games. Ever since the Sega Saturn days, Sonic games have not been what they used to be back during the amazing games on Genesis and Sonic CD. I was wondering what thoughts you guys have on the franchise since Sonic Adventure on the Dreamcast, up to what they have done with it on Sonic Colors. The next-gen Sonic games started out on HD consoles, and ever since then, Sonic games have spent most time on the Wii and DS. I'm sure you have plenty to say on Sonic and why so many fans seem to keep supporting it.
Mm.
Who wants to talk about Resident Evil or Sonic, and or?
They're very similar in my mind, actually, that I haven't played very many. No, I mean, they're not franchises I really like. I've played games in them that I'm not that fond of, and then I've played games that I'm considerably more fond of, but, you know, that I'm not, like, compelled to play most of the ones that come out for Nintendo systems or anything. They don't have, like, a cherished place in my heart. I mean, Resident Evil 2... I played that on N64.
I'm sorry. Not the best platform for that game.
No, definitely not. But I played through it, and I stuck with it, even though I wasn't like crazy about it. And, you know, it wasn't like a painful experience or anything. I got something out of it, but, you know, it didn't do a whole lot for me. And then RE4, obviously, I mean, the reception was overwhelming critically, so I was moved to get it because of that. And it is very different, and it's an action game, and I enjoyed it. But to the extent that I did enjoy it, you know, have I gone out and got RE5? No. Have I got, like, you know, the Umbrella Chronicle stuff or anything? No. So that's the kind of space that it occupies in my mind.
My personal feeling is I played Resident Evil 1 and 2 on PlayStation, and didn't like either one of them. I wouldn't have even played the second one, except everybody told me it was so much better, and I was like, no, it's the same. And then I think I rented it and played it on N64 just to kind of see what it looked like, because I couldn't believe they put FMV on an N64 cartridge.
They did,
sort of.
Highly pixelized, but yes.
Yeah.
It certainly wasn't more fun on N64. It just looked worse, actually. And then I didn't really touch any Resident Evil until 4, and I actually remember playing the Resident Evil 4 demo at E3 that year, or it came out in January, so it was actually the year before, and, you know, it was in the village, and the village can be quite frustrating, actually, because you kind of have to survive for a certain amount of time. It's not really clear what you're supposed to be doing or where you're supposed to be going. I thought it was really hard, and that's kind of all I thought about it, and it wasn't until I wrote a review. I don't know if it was a review copy or if I went out and bought it, but, I played it on GameCube when the final version came out, and I don't think that game really hooked me until you get out of the village and you start seeing some of the RPG and adventure elements of it, and you start realizing the scope of it, because it's such an enormous game with so many weapons, so many interesting gameplay ideas, and for the first time, it's not that the story makes a whole lot of sense in Resident Evil 4, but it's certainly told far, far, far better than it ever had been in the series, and they actually make it seem pretty interesting and exciting to follow. So that game just blew my mind, and I really consider it pretty much as separate from the games before it.
It's so different.
Yeah, it's a reboot.
Although, I mean, in some ways, I would say, like, just the fact that it was Resident Evil probably enhanced my enjoyment of it from the point of view, like, I couldn't believe it kept going, like, and it kept broadening out. When you play RE2, and it's like, okay, I'm going to be in this police station for ages, aren't I? And then there's going to be, like, some underground lab somewhere that it's going to lead to, you know, and you're not really consciously thinking about it, but you kind of think it's going to be similar with the village in four, and then it just keeps opening up and up and up and going to these crazy settings, you know, like it's almost like some sort of next generation Castlevania game at one point with the castle setting. And the...
It honestly made me think of Zelda.
Yeah, I mean, you do see that diversity of geography.
Well, and the puzzles are really good.
It's just at the time it was just shocking. I mean, it really
blew my mind. It still blows my mind. I've played that game two or three times all the way through, and it's one of my favorite games. And if you told me 6 or 7 years ago that one of my favorite games of all time would be in the Resident Evil franchise, I would have spat on you, because I really dislike the first two games.
Extreme.
Other than the soundtrack for RE2, I have nothing good to say about
either. The soundtrack is really good in RE2, as we said, but yeah, that was pretty much as far as it went for me with that one.
John, what are your feelings on that series?
I mean, I like it. I mean, I really, like everybody else, I really liked RE4.
Did you play, like, Code Veronica or any of that kind of stuff?
No. I've played RE2. Did I get it for N64? I don't think I did. I think I played that. Yeah.
The proud. Come on, John.
That's the thing.
Tell me there was someone else.
I've just never been able to get into the controls of it. That's why I liked RE4 so much. I mean, and it was kind of one of those things where, you know, I had heard so much about it, like everybody else was like especially RE2. RE2 was so amazing and everything. The controls are terrible. I mean, I was watching a demo. I think it was, they were showing RE1 being played on like the Sony's new phone.
The PS phone.
And oh my God, watching somebody play that game now, it's terrible. It's maddening watching somebody, because your guy like moves slowly to the left,
yes,
and then walks and walks. It looks ridiculous. I mean, I can't believe, even back then, I couldn't believe that people thought that was actually a fun game to play.
Well, you know? I think it was
cool. Its setting was cool, and it did a lot of, you know, cool things with FMV and all that. But the controls, man. Oh,
the reason 4 had to be the way it was because at that point, it had become a joke.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody recognized that series was fundamentally flawed.
And that's the reason I've never played the remake for GameCube of the first game.
No, I haven't.
Everybody says
either.
It looks amazing and it sounds so good, and I'm like, that sounds great, but if it still plays like the first Resident Evil, I don't want to be anywhere near it.
Yeah, so I played RE2 on the N64. I got it from like Blockbuster for like $3 when they were clearing out games.
Mm-hmm. That's probably a little cheaper than I got it on import.
Oof. And I beat it. Although I thought, this is really shit. And not just because it was the crappy N64 port, it just didn't feel good. I mean, I was like, this game doesn't feel good at all. And at some point, somebody got me Resident Evil Zero when it was on clearance from like a discount bin.
Oh, right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure I've told the story, but I never made it past the first room of that game.
In that case, I probably played more of it than you.
Yeah. You played more of it on N64.
That's right.
That's the one where they go on the train, right?
Yeah, I never got out of that the first car of that train because I was like, fuck this game. This isn't fun.
I mean, it's like, I mean, I play like 5 minutes of a game to begin with, but that one I played like 3.
Oh, cut in. 60%.
Yeah.
Sonic, really quickly. Sonic sucks. Never liked him.
I liked the first game.
See, I didn't like the first game. That's the only one I played back in
the
day.
I like the second one and the third.
Well, John likes it. Didn't say he played it.
Oh, that was back when I had time to play games.
I admire the Sonic franchise for trying to speed up platforming, because certainly Mario, you know, which was the standard, is the standard, is a slow game.
Even with the
time. So I think it's an interesting challenge to try to speed up that gameplay and kind of change the pace of a 2D platformer. I just never liked the way that Sonic went about that. You know, I know we talk about it too much, but Super Meat Boy is a very fast platformer that has none of the problems of Sonic. So I just think there are other ways to do it, and Sonic has, you know, I don't know that Sonic as a concept can be saved, because the very premise of the game is that the character moves faster than you can see. And when you can't see the level, it feels like you're not playing the game anymore. And that's exactly how I've always felt about every Sonic game.
Well, because, I mean, I played Russian Colors in the last 5 years or whatever. I enjoyed both of them. They haven't made me into a Sonic fan or anything. They're not that awesome. And I have some of the same underlying problems with the whole template as you do. But I think the one thing they did with Colors is those power-ups do provide, like, a break from the run all the time. Yeah, they provide slower paced bits of gameplay most of the time. Not all of them, but quite a few of them just slow it down and make it kind of interesting while they do that. breaking the monotony of some of the Sonic games without just being like Sonic Rush, for instance. I do like it, but some of the way that it tries to break things up is kill rooms, which is not a good idea
in any game.
Well, especially in a fast platformer.
Yeah, Sonic kill rooms like the great combat of Sonic. good God. But you know, and so I think, you know, having like different power-ups, different gameplay styles in place of crap like that is definitely a way in which you can kind of still have the emphasis on speed and actually kind of highlight the speed more, because as we sort of said with the horror thing, you know, contrast brings it out. So I think that was a positive step, but how far they can take it in that direction, I don't know.
I mean, as to why so many fans seem to keep supporting Sonic,
Stockholm syndrome.
I don't think they do. I think most of Sonic's old fans have moved on and or given up in disgust. And I think the reason that Sonic games continue to be somewhat successful is because they continue to bring in new people, just like Pokemon, who don't care about the series' faults, because they don't, you know, they don't stay with it long enough to actually see that stuff play out over multiple games. And I think Sonic, like Pokemon, is easy to market effectively, and Sega knows how to do that. I think they know how to sell Sonic much better than they know how to make Sonic, and that's good enough for them.
Well, part of the issue with the Sonic franchise as it exists is exactly what Johnny said. They've come out in the past and said, yeah, we still sell these games to kids.
They've kind of commoditized it as well. I mean, that's the thing. It's so cranked out.
Right. I mean, it's almost not even a game franchise as much as it is a franchise game.
A product line.
Yeah, it's more like when a TV show gets a game versus when a game gets a TV show.
Why do they put Werehog in Sonic Unleashed? Not because it's going to make the game more fun, because it looks cool to a five-year-old.
Exactly.
Everything else is secondary.
You get these gimmicks where, you know, when you have so many games in a short space of time, you have to throw in some gimmicks to differentiate as well.
Yeah.
And when those two, you know, when the marketing intersects with that, that's where you get Werehog.
Well, you know what, though? You can cut... That's where you get Werehog.
I was doing hand gestures.
Yeah, put that on a graph.
But see,
here, this is where the two points intersect.
You can see,
is Werehog.
You can see this in other franchises that basically just cranked out their platforming games. You can see it in some of the early PlayStation platforming games, like their Spyro,
Crash Bandicoot.
But you can see it in their PS2 ones in like the Jax and Dexter series, where like they turned them into like this badass gray skin macho machine, and then they turned them into like a robot make. I mean, they did all kinds of shit with that game.
I just think a lot of former Sonic fans, or, you know, Sonic fans in waiting, keep talking about how they want the series to go back to its roots and get rid of all the characters and fix the controls. And that has no appeal to me, because I didn't think the original games were all that good either. I think Sonic 2 is totally playable, and Sonic 3 is kind of more playable because of the shield powers, but they're not great platformers. And again, it's my opinion, I never liked them that much to begin with, so there's nothing for Sonic to go back to that will make me love it. So for me, they're going to have to do something new that is completely different than what they've ever done before, and they're not going to do that.
And then it's not Sonic anymore anyway?
Look, if you want to know where Sonic really jumped the shark, it's with Sonic Adventure. And I know people love to love that game because it was a Dreamcast launch title, but it's not a good game. It is not. It never was.
Big the
never
cat.
A good game. Just because Sonic Adventure 2 is a little bit worse, and all the Sonic games after that got a little bit worse, doesn't mean Sonic Adventure was good in the first place, because it's not.
I know people who like Sonic Adventure 2 more than Sonic Adventure, because it has more of the Sonic stuff in it.
Well, and that's where all those shitty characters come from. Before that, Knuckles was as crazy as it got, and then, well, I guess Amy showed up in, what, Sonic CD? But Sonic Adventure is where all the characters, all the shitty friends, that's where they came from.
Yep, because they had to have something to do in 3D, aside from make Sonic run around.
There was a Sonic character before that was really, really shitty.
So it's not really narrowing it down.
I mean, like unbelievably.
No, really shitty, even by Sonic.
Like Mega Sonic.
Like embarrassingly shitty.
Oh, Fang the Sniper. That was from... also known as Knack the Weasel. That was
wow.
He was in a Game Gear game called Sonic Triple Trouble.
Wow.
Moving on.
He's got a fucking cowboy hat.
Moving on. James, you have the last letter.
Joe Ladau writes, I recently received my first HDTV, and I'm thinking about getting a second console. He notes that he already owns a Wii. I have not been paying too much attention to either the PS3 or the Xbox 360, and have no clue which one I should get, and I'm asking the gamers I know does not give me much in the way of useful information, parenthetically noting that they say Xbox sucks. Which would you guys recommend? Some information that may be useful. 1. I'm pretty much a lifelong Nintendo guy, although I did have a PS2. 2. That he cannot play any game that's in the first person due to motion sickness, so those games don't factor in.
Wow.
He has no interest in Kinect or Move, and he is planning on picking up Blu-ray at some point. And, quote, I generally enjoy platformers, DKC or Mario, and adventure games, Zelda, and loathe sports games. On the PS2, I enjoyed Twisted Metal Black, Sly Cooper, and the GTA series.
Well, I mean, that's the thing.
It's so multi-plat now. I mean,
before, it used to only see things come out on PC and 360. But now they're coming out on PC, 360, and PS3.
Well, and also, pretty much across the board. The gap is narrowing in terms of the difference between the versions.
Yeah.
You know, there have been some cases in the past where PS3 versions have really not been that great.
Yeah.
It's not an issue unless you want to play, like, those early generation titles.
Yeah, I mean, if you're worried about going back to those, then maybe 360 might be better in that case. With PS3, for newer games, the gap has kind of closed in that regard. I mean, the one thing that isn't said here is how much do you care about online?
Yeah.
Because for me, one of the things with PS3, I didn't see it as much of a downside that PSN is not as, you know, vibrant as live, because I just don't care that much about online gaming. And I'd rather have the option to do it without having to pay if I ever feel like it, than paying and kind of feeling obligated to do it.
Yeah.
Well, and if you don't play first-person shooters, you probably don't care as much about online games.
Or sports games, though, because those two kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah, right. The sports games as well. So, I mean, it maybe points more to PS3 if you care about, or you might think you could enjoy some of the PS3 exclusives like Uncharted.
Yeah, but then again, you know, with Xbox Live, I think that Xbox Live Arcade is much, much better than PSN. There's, you know, there's a couple of things like Shadow Complex and stuff that you just can't get on PS3.
Well, to get into that, I mean, Joe mentions that he likes platformers and adventure games.
Mm-hmm.
And first off, if you want stuff like Zelda, you're pretty much shit out of luck outside of Darksiders, which is on both systems.
3D Dot Game Heroes, though, is PS3 exclusive.
Yes.
It's, yeah.
I know it's old school Zelda, but
I soured on that game pretty quickly. I played a lot of it, but I don't think it's that great.
It's pretty generic.
Well, it's generic by design, though. I mean,
yeah.
It's you actually make your own characters and stuff, but it's a respectable Zelda knockoff with a fun look.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's not a great game. It's not something to base a selection on.
No. But I'll just say, in terms of like Darksiders is on both,
right.
Whereas 3D Dot Game Heroes is only on PS3.
Sure. I think in terms of platformers, especially if you're talking about 2D platformers, you're not going to get those on a disc on either system. But for download stuff, you're better off with Xbox. There's more and better 2D platformers on Xbox Live Arcade than there are on PSN. Outside of that, I don't think it makes that... I mean, based on the information that Joe has provided here, I don't think it makes a huge difference, because I don't think one or the other system has more games that are more Nintendo-like. And I would say that if you would like to play a sort of a modern shooter that's not first-person, you could play Gears of War on Xbox, which is... Those games are excellent, and they're not first-person, so they may not bother you as much. I would also say that if you haven't tried playing a first-person game in a while, you might want to try it again, because if the game's running at 60 frames per second, it's much less likely to cause motion sickness than older generation stuff would. So, for instance, if GoldenEye bothers you on N64, that the fact that it runs at 10 frames per second is a major contributor to that. So playing a modern game that runs on a high-end engine on a HD console, it can make a big difference. The other thing is, just in general, motion sickness is an adaptation that can be overcome with practice and training. If things like first-person shooters cause you motion sickness, you can actually get over that with time, the same way you could get over a fear of heights if you trained it in a certain way. In this case, you might want to play not a game with a worse frame rate, but play a slower paced game in first person, like Oblivion, like an RPG that's in first person or something like that.
I mean, I was coming to my purchase from a similar angle. I guess Blu-ray was probably the biggest tiebreaker, yeah. And Joe kind of alludes to that here, so that might well be it. But there were a few games that I think I enjoyed more connected back to like old Nintendo experiences. I mean, I like Little Big Planet, and I know Johnny's not so fond of it, but you know, that's you've got the second one coming out as well. You know, maybe that could go into the decision. And also the Ratchet & Clank. The most recent one, Kraken Time. I enjoyed that. Kind of satisfied a similar level to obviously Jet Force Gemini, and a lot of the way the presentation kind of reminded me of Rare stuff from the past.
I don't think it's as good as any of those games, but there aren't that many games being made like it now. So.
Yeah, and I mean, you could probably come in and get that for a song now. I mean, I did, like, 2 months after it came out. I mean, so like all this time after now, I mean, that's the cool thing about coming in at this point is that there's a lot of stuff that you can, you know, to have a punt on.
Yeah.
Just go for it. You're only spending $20 or maybe less, and you could just gamble and see if it's something you would like. And if you do, then there's more to be found in that area.
Yeah, he also mentions Twisted Metal Black. I think Twisted Metal 3 is coming out for PS3.
Eventually.
Yeah. It is. There's not much known about it.
Jaffe's I'm not going to be the Alabama coach. Routine.
Yeah.
I would just sit there and go through what currently is still exclusive, and you'd probably just want to look at first party stuff and second party stuff, because that's probably, I mean, that's not going anywhere.
In terms of quality of hardware, they're both about the same now that they've both been revised to their more slimmer versions. I think they're both very high quality systems now.
Yeah. I mean, if you care about Blu-ray, PS3.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's not that easy. That used to be the answer. But Blu-ray players have gotten so much cheaper now that you could potentially buy an Xbox and a Blu-ray player for about the same price you could get a PS3. So, I mean, the difference being then you have to hook up two systems and it takes up more shelf space.
That's the practical concerns might be more the issue. Certainly. There with like your AV setup.
Certainly. I use the PS3 as a Blu-ray player. It is very good for that. It's still one of the better Blu-ray players out there.
That's kind
of
sad.
So anyway, it's unfortunately we don't have an easy answer for you, but I do think either way you're going to be satisfied, because at this point there aren't massive differences in what the two platforms offer. There used to be, and they've come a lot closer within the past few years. And so really, you know, what few exclusive games there still are might be the tipping point for you. Blu-ray might be the tipping point if you don't want to spin for a separate box. So really look at that. But I don't think there's an obvious solution in terms of which one is better for people who like Nintendo games. I don't really think there's a very obvious answer to that.
Yeah,
nah,
I would agree.
Okay, well, that's going to do it for listener mail. Thanks to everybody who wrote in. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. I will mention we've gotten some really good emails just in the past few days that we couldn't fit in here. We will get to those. And we will get to new emails as well, so please keep sending them in. They've been awesome. There's a new retroactive poll up. It's actually our second chance edition. So it has GBA games, Game Boy Color, N64, and DS. Please go to the Nintendo World Report forums. We'll try to get something on the front page. I actually wanted this to kind of go quicker than in the past. So this show goes up on Sunday. That poll ends on Thursday, January 20th. So seriously, you're listening to this, get to a computer and vote on retroactive, because it's not going to stick around for very long. You've got a narrow window here because we want to announce the winner on the next episode next week. So vote now. Do not delay or you'll miss your chance. It's going to be a fun one. These are all games that were popular in previous polls. They're getting a second chance to win. One of them will be chosen for us to play and for you to play and discuss here in a few weeks. Of course, you can check us out on iTunes, rate and review us. We'd really appreciate it. And again, on Facebook.com/RadioFreeNintendo, you can get sort of midweek updates. People are posting their online account names and things like that to sync up that way. Who knows what's going to be up there? We don't know. Photos and all kinds of crazy stuff. All right, well, that's it. Join us next week when we react to the big 3DS reveal. It's going to be quite exciting, and maybe we'll be disgusted or really excited. I don't know. Thanks, everybody.
Later.
Peace out.
Bye-bye.
You know, we had That's Where Werehog Happens, but I mean, you have to go back and look at the Shadow character.
What?
So first off, the Shadow character was broody, emo bullshit in the first game, and then he turned into like a gangster rapper in the second game. It's Shadow the Hedgehog. He had like his double gats, and he was driving his car with the hood
you imagine
the roof down.
If,
it was
if someone had the bravery to make Shadow the Hedgehog blood on the sand, how good would that be?
I mean,
shooting down helicopters.
Yeah,
give me that fucking skull.
It's like
lucky motherfucker.
It's like. Did you guys really think this through? I mean, the problem with the with that franchise, and I think,
is that it's a soulless, vacuous nothing.
Actually,
look, Mario
yes.
is designed by artists, and I'm not exaggerating here. The Mario franchise is designed and continues to be designed by creative, artistic people. The Sonic franchise is designed by marketing people. It may be developed by creative people, but they have no control over it whatsoever.
Now, he was a focus-tested character. Like, he was yeah. he was Poochie the dog.
He was. That's the amazing thing. He literally was Poochie the dog.
Before Poochie. Yeah. Before, Poochie probably wasn't directly mocking Sonic, but, you know, he's mocking things like him.
There's like a...
So what we're saying is, to in order to redeem the Sonic franchise, Sonic
kill
has
it.
To say...
Kill it with fire.
Sonic has to say, I have to go now, my home planet needs me, at which point the animation cell is removed from the screen with a woo sound effect, and that's it.
Yes, can we do that?